Resting Places.
Well, tonight's resting place is a couple of things. It is our final resting place, not in that way. It is the last one that we'll be visiting as part of this series on the world's most interesting cemeteries. And secondly, although it is a burial site, it's not considered to be a resting place at all. At the top of a mountain, along a pathway that winds for 2 kilometres, flanked by enormous cedar trees, is Japan's Okonuen Temple. It's home to more than 200,000 memorial stones for the famous samurai, monks, and everyday people who were buried there. But Okonuen Temple is considered to be a sanctuary for eternal meditation, not a graveyard. Well, to show us around is Richard Farmer. He manages the group tour program for the Inside Travel Group. He's based in Japan. Hello, Richard. Thanks for joining us here on Nightlife.
Hi, great to be here.
All right, what makes Okonuen an extraordinary place in your view?
Yeah, well, I think it's the only place of its kind in Japan, and I guess in the world. You have this really huge area with this 2 kilometer kind of cedar lined path running through it. And it just feels, if you've come to Japan and you've spent some time in Tokyo or Osaka or Hiroshima or, some of those big cities, if you then visit Mount Koya as part of your trip and the Okonuen Cemetery, it's just going to feel so different to everything you've seen so far. None of the neon lights of Tokyo. And you can just really feel that that history. It's evolved and grown up over more than 1,000 years, and you can really kind of feel that, the kind of sense of place that you get there.
So the centerpiece is the mausoleum of someone called Kobodashi. Who was Kobodashi, and what's his role in this whole situation that we're talking about tonight?
Yes, I guess Kobodashi. Most people outside of Japan probably haven't heard of him, but actually within Japanese history, he's a really central figure, and there will be, I think, very few people in Japan that don't know his name. He was a monk. His life kind of crossed the latter half of the 8th century and the beginning of the 9th century. So he was alive about 1,200 years ago. And during his life, he actually had a different name. He was called Kukai. And Kobodaishi, which is the name by which he's often referred to now, was a kind of posthumous honorific name granted to him by an emperor about 100 years after his death. And Kobodaishi means the grand master who spread the Dharma, which is the Buddhist teachings. He's principally famous for being someone who went to China. And he traveled to China in 804. And Buddhism had already been established in Japan for a good 300 years at that point. But he went to China actually on a kind of imperially government-sponsored mission to go to China, where Buddhism already had a longer history, to kind of fact-find and gather more information. And he was actually given some pocket money. He was given a big budget to go, and he was told to go and spend at least 10 years there to learn as much as possible and gather various sutras, like Buddhist texts, that hadn't made their way to Japan yet. But he came back after 2. So he came back in 806, 8 years earlier than he was supposed to.
Why was he back early? Oh, he spent all the money.
he spent all the money, and he said, I've learned everything I need to. I only needed 2 years, and I found this new and interesting and amazing type of Buddhism that hasn't made its way to Japan yet, which he called Shingon, which means like the true word. This type of Buddhism is often referred to as esoteric Buddhism in English, kind of like a secret teachings. Everyone these days has heard of Zen, which I think is probably the most well-known type of Japanese Buddhism around the world. But actually, Zen is just one small part of Japanese Buddhism, and there are quite a lot of different sects, each with their own focus. And this new Shingon Buddhism that Kobodaishi introduced really focuses on secret teachings transmitted from master to disciple, focusing on things like mudras, these like sacred hand gestures, which are often performed in kind of combinations, mantras, which are kind of sacred utterances. And there's even a sacred mantra that's now associated with Korbo Daishi. People kind of say it to pay homage to him, which is Namu Daishi Henjo Kongo. It kind of means like, you know, great thanks to the great teacher Korbo Daishi. And then also meditation techniques, but quite different from Zen meditation techniques. The Shingon meditation techniques that Kukai brought back from China and introduced focus on a lot of kind of visualization style meditations and using mandalas, these kind of sacred depictions of the Buddhist cosmos. But so many of these teachings are transmitted secretly from master to disciple. And so actually the kind of lay public are not privy to a lot of these teachings, which are just passed from monk to monk, for example. Mm-hmm.
Richard Farmer is with us. Richard's the Group Tour Program Manager for Inside Travel Group. We're learning about a place called Okonuin. It's a resting, sort of a resting place. We'll understand more about that in a moment, in Japan. Some of you may even have been there. If you have, you might like to give me a call and tell me about your visit, 1-300-800-222. So even though the place we're talking about, Richard, I think it's a couple of hours away from Osaka, it is the site of Korbo Daishi's mausoleum. According to tradition, he never actually died. Can you explain how that works?
Yes. So, when he departed this world, let's say in 835 AD, you know, it's said that he didn't die, but he entered a kind of eternal meditation. And it's said that he's basically waiting for the next Buddha to arrive in the world. So in this Shingon Buddhist cosmology, the idea is that, you know, the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago in India was just one of many Buddhas who have been and you know, will come in the future. And so the next Buddha, who is called Maitreya, will arrive in about 5 billion years. So we've got a little bit longer to wait. But the idea is that Korbo Daishi is sitting in his eternal meditation in the mausoleum at the very far end of Okonoyan Cemetery, waiting for Maitreya to arrive. And when Maitreya, the future Buddha, does appear, Korbo Daishi will kind of wake up and start his teachings all over again. So it's quite an interesting concept. And it's said that you know, once Korbo Daishi entered this eternal meditation 1,200 years ago, after a short period, it's not really specified how long it was, but they kind of reopened the mausoleum to kind of check in on him. And it said that his body hadn't decayed at all. He was still sitting there in his meditation, and his hair had even grown a little bit. And so he's still sitting there in the cemetery.
How long since anyone's checked on him, though?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? Yeah. but he is actually, he's served meals every day still.
What?
By the monks that live there. So, yeah, they take him breakfast and lunch. He has two meals a day. And, I mean, it would seem that he doesn't have much of an appetite these days. But, yeah, I don't believe they actually open the doors to the mausoleum itself. It's kind of left outside as an offering. But, yeah, that still happens daily.
Okay, eternal breakfast. I love it.
Yeah.
And so when Korbo Daishi died then, how did this mausoleum and this particular site, Okonuin, sort of develop around his, you know, his mausoleum and you know, setting up a place to remember him?
Yeah, well, during his life, you know, he had become such a prolific figure and kind of regarded as a bit of a miracle maker. So actually, even now, when you travel around Japan, you know, you'll find all of these places where it's like, yes, this well was discovered by Korbo Daishi, or yes, this bridge was first built by Korbo Daishi. And, you know, if he had gone around Japan and done all of these things, he would have been a very busy monk indeed. But this kind of image of him as like a genius and a miracle maker. He's even credited with introducing Japan's alphabetic writing system, for example. And so there's this kind of power associated with the figure of Korbo Daishi, even after kind of leaving this world and entering his eternal meditation. And so many people wanted to be, you know, after their own deaths, close to Korbo Daishi. after their death. And so, of course, wanted to, you know, have their remains also interred near his mausoleum. And that's kind of how Okunoin Cemetery started to evolve, people wanting to be buried near here. And so they're kind of there to join the party in 5 billion years' time when he wakes up.
So how big is this site then, Richard? And who owns it?
Well, it's owned by the Koya San Shingon Buddhist sect. Mm-hmm. So Okunoin is, you know, a really big area on Mount Koya. But Mount Koya, actually, you know, a lot of people are surprised to see that it's actually a town. You go up into a mountain and then there's this quite large plateau where Okunoin Cemetery is, Koya-san town itself, Kongo-buji temple, and another temple, which is a huge monastic complex, which is the kind of brain of Mount Koya, where even now, you know, many monks are in training. And so it's quite a big place, but, you know, Okunoin is kind of the beating heart of the whole Mount Koya complex. So you've got this 2 kilometer path that goes through, you know, these towering cedar trees, and then, you know, at the very end you reach Kobo Daishi's mausoleum, which is kind of the center point. But, you know, all through that, it's not just a path, you know, where you're just walled in, you know, it sprawls out in all directions. There are smaller little paths that branch off through the cedars. It's really, you feel really kind of cut off from the world in there, because it's such a big cemetery. And what's quite interesting about it is, you know, so many of the graves that are there, it's kind of like a who's who of Japan's famous figures throughout history. So you've got very famous samurai with graves there, even like daimyo, the Japanese feudal lords from, you know, 500 years ago, 600 years ago, members of the Tokugawa family, this hugely important family in Japanese history that kind of ruled Japan for 250 years from the 1600s. So, if you're a Japanese history buff, you will see a lot of names that will be familiar as you walk through the cemetery. Yeah.
And then, Richard, there are also some surprisingly modern memorials tucked among the gravestones, including monuments that have been paid for by major Japanese companies. What's the reason for that?
Yeah, so that's what's really interesting about it is, you know, it's not just the past, you know, the present is well represented there too. And in a way, the Okunoin area, it kind of feels like there's two sections. There's the very kind of enclosed, very old feeling part where you have the cedar line path and everything's very like covered in moss as you walk through. But actually there's a whole extra part kind of adjacent to that, which is the more modern cemetery, which is where, yeah, as you say, there are even some of the big names of Japanese companies represented there with kind of company graves. So you'll find one from Panasonic, for example, and their company grave is very interesting. They've got like this kind of very large, rectangular, highly polished granite slab as the centerpiece of their monument, which is meant to look like a flat screen TV. And then you have UCC Coffee, which is one of the, you know, really big companies in Japan that produces instant coffee. And their company grave has a really big coffee cup made of like gray marble. And then actually, if you go and look up inside and peer into it, there's a slab of like brown marble inside, kind of making it look like this granite cup is full of coffee. You have like Nissan, and the big car company has a grave there. And really interestingly, there's one grave from a company that specializes in termite extermination. And they've created a grave there basically as a way of saying sorry to the termites.
Are there actually like company employees buried there, or are they just kind of monuments and their people's names listed on it? How, you know, can you get into one of these company graves anymore?
Yeah, so it's very much a choice. So of course, you know, if you're an employee of one of these big companies, by no means are you forced to join the company grave after your death. But it's an option.
And it's still an option. There's plenty of room there still, is there?
Right. Well, so in Japan, people are almost always cremated. And it's actually not uncommon in Japan to have your ashes after your death kind of divided. So you can have like a small little urn that's kept in the household family altar at home. You can have another small urn that's kind of kept in like the family's parishioner temple, and then maybe another portion of ashes kind of put into a grave. So it's kind of up to the employees if they want just a small portion of their ashes interned in the company grave. But I think it all comes back to something that is changing in the present day. But lifetime employment in Japan has always been a big thing. This idea that you graduate from university, you join a big company in Japan, and then you work there, right the way through your 20s, all the way through your retirement. And that kind of group mentality as well that I think exists in Japan. I'm from the UK, and I think in the West we have this very individualistic culture. But Japanese culture has a lot of a much stronger kind of group mentality, and this idea that you have your company has paid perhaps a bigger part in your life. You've been there your whole working career, and so it kind of becomes like a family, I suppose. And also a way, if you have this company grave there, a way of for current employees to show their gratitude to their predecessors, for example, as well. So you're kind of thanking all of the people who have gone before you, founding and building these companies.
You're right, Richard. I reckon if there was an ABC radio grave, I could happily donate a bit of my ashes to go in there.
Right.
I can,
Yeah,
that
just
could
a
work
bit.
for me. Yeah, not the whole thing, just a little bit. Richard Farmer is here. He's a Group Tour Program Manager for Inside Travel Group. So when you go to visit, what's the dress code for going to Okinawa?
Yes, it's interesting actually, because just this year, Mount Koya themselves, the monastic organization, have actually created new guidelines about this. Previously, there weren't really any, and I think it's probably come about due to perhaps some issues that have been sprouting up now that more and more international visitors are going there and perhaps aren't really properly considering in advance that this is kind of it's a working religious site. And so there's now a request for people that visit to well, basically just not wear anything too revealing. So you're requested to kind of wear clothes that cover your back and your shoulders. So like no tank tops, that kind of thing, and no short shorts or skirts. It's best to wear kind of longer trousers, and also not to wear yukata, the kind of informal Japanese kimono. At like festivals and things like that in Japan, people will often wear these, but they're almost like kind of pajamas, and so they're not really considered appropriate either. But as long as you're there, wearing just a regular t-shirt and some long longer trousers, then you'll be perfectly compliant
Yeah.
with their requests.
And does Okinawa change with the seasons? Is there a time of year when it's particularly magical to visit?
I mean, I love it at all times of year. Before my current role, now I work, as you said, as the Group Tour Program Manager at Inside Travel Group. But for about 8 years, I was one of our tour leaders. So I led our group tours on the ground. So I've been to Okinawa dozens of times over the years with our various hidden Japan small group tour groups. And I always had a soft spot for summer. These days, if you kind of Google when should I go to Japan or when should I not go to Japan, it feels like the internet kind of screams at you, don't go in summer, it's so hot, it's so humid. And it is hot and it is humid, but for me, it's always when Japan feels most Japan. Like when you're walking through Okinawa in the summer, you have all of the cicadas and the insects, kind of sometimes just like a deafening chorus as you walk through with the cicadas kind of chirping away. And of course, Mount Koya, it's at about 800 meters or so in elevation, so it's a little bit cooler up there than when you're down in the big cities like Kyoto and Osaka, for example. But conversely, winter can feel quite magical as well. Mount Koya gets a bit of snow, not meters and meters of it, but everything, all of the graves and so on, when they've got a light dusting of snow, looks pretty magical as well. But it's definitely a place for all seasons with their own charms, I would say.
Well, it sounds most extraordinary. A guy who apparently hasn't died, who's getting two meals a day. Meanwhile, we have, you know, Panasonic and its big screen monument. I love it. Thank you. Sounds like such a fascinating place. Thank you so much, Richard, for joining us here on Nightlife to take us there tonight.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Richard Farmer is Group Tour Program Manager for Inside Travel Group.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.